Hi everyone, and welcome back to That UFO Podcast. As always, my name is Andy, and welcome to the show this week. This is your Transmission Highlights Volume 2, where on this show I'll play some extended clips from interviews I've had in the last couple of weeks. But just to let you know, there is a huge 8 weeks ahead to end the year. Just today I've locked in dates with near enough 9 different guests that will see you through to the new year. Plus, of course, this month there will be a few shows on the Age of Disclosure documentary due to drop on the 21st of November. Very curious to see what type of public reaction that one gets. And there'll be some shorter shows coming out where I'm going to be playing some clips from interviews I've done previously, but in connection with the book you may have heard I released, Atlas of UFOs, which is available. Thank you to everyone who's bought a copy. If you haven't, it was just plugged on News Nation with Ross Coulthart on Reality Check. And thank you very much to Ross for doing so. The book is a great gift for people leading up to Christmas or the holidays, for yourself or for someone else. Do check it out. If you have bought it already, huge thanks again. But please leave a review on Amazon. It makes a massive, massive difference. But anyway, listen, this show is all about the clips from interviews I've played in the last couple of weeks. You're going to hear from Greg Rogers in a lengthy clip where he talks about his experience of seeing what he says as a flying saucer while he was working in a medical capacity at Cape Canaveral. And it was on CCTV, and he describes the incident in great detail. Then Reed Summers joins me, host of the Emergent podcast, with some highlights of our conversation. Really popular guest. Reed will be back on with me in a few weeks. That is by audience demand, I promise you that. So get your questions over to me if you have questions for Reed ASAP. Brilliant insight, wonderfully fresh, unique take on a lot of things as well. I really enjoyed that conversation. And finally, highlights from my interview with Professor Gary Nolan. We touch on a lot of his thoughts on where we are right now in terms of the UAP conversation, Skywatcher's work, his involvement, and a whole lot more. Of course, if you haven't checked out the full interviews, then hopefully these tasters spur you on to go and do that. You can check out the ad-free version of the podcast and support me directly via Patreon, via Apple, via Spotify if you type in That UFO Podcast Premium, or on YouTube if you sign up for a membership. But Apple and Patreon have, I would say, some of the best value because you get free trials on there as well. So please go and check that out. If you can support, do so. You get bonus content, early access, and you don't have to listen to any adverts. But all of that aside, loads of content to come this month, like I've said. So please make sure you've hit follow, subscribe, like, etc. on whichever platform. And let's hand over to the guests, and I will speak to you all very, very soon.
Okay, I'll be glad to do that. Back in 1992, as I had mentioned, one of my duties was to monitor all of the medical operations going on at Cape Canaveral. Now, medical operations also included the medical safety guidelines for all of our operations. So whenever there was any sort of operation that had an element of danger to it, we had to ensure that we were protecting the safety of all of our workers. That could include not just mechanical problems, but also electromagnetic problems, ionizing radiation. We had hypergolic fuel, and it had an oxidizer. The fuel was hydrazine and monomethylhydrazine, and then the oxidizer was nitrogen tetroxide. Well, nitrogen tetroxide is extremely dangerous. As soon as it reaches air, it turns into a red gas. And so one of the things that I learned there was we did it as a joke, but we always said that at Cape Canaveral, you never wanted to come in contact with the BRC. And so, that sounded mysterious. And when I first heard it, they were teasing me because I was a novice when I first got there. And I said, okay, I give up, guys. What's a BRC? And they said, a big red cloud. If nitrogen tetroxide leaks, it forms a big red cloud. If you see a big red cloud, run. If you even breathe, it might be the last thing you do. you cannot inhale this during space shuttle launches, for instance. I had to carry certain types of antidotes to some of the chemicals that were aboard the space shuttle. And so if there was a catastrophic failure, one of the first things I was going to do was inject everyone in my helicopter with these antidotes so that we could try to go rescue everyone else. Because if we came in contact with some of these chemicals, if you were untreated, you could go into convulsions immediately. And if you're trying to fly a helicopter in the midst of convulsions, it's not going to work out very well. So on this particular day, I was going up to the Cape, and the EG&G facilities had some new operations that they had initiated along with the contractors for the rocket engines, the satellites, and so forth. And so on this particular day, I got to the Cape and I met an EG&G escort. And so he was going to take me to three different locations on Cape Canaveral, and he was going to show me what the new functions were. So we went to the first building, went inside, he showed it to me. I said, okay, great. Now I know what it is. So we went to the second building. He escorted me inside. We took a look at it, said, okay, that's really interesting. Now I understand that. So then we went to the third building, and it was a classified building. Most everything at Cape Canaveral is. You can't take a picture on Cape Canaveral without clearance. You can't get onto the military installation unless you have specified clearance to do so. So I've mentioned there would be times that 2 and 3 star generals would be on vacation in Florida, and they would drive up to the front gate at Cape Canaveral and say, "Hey, I want to get a tour. Can you let me in here? I'm a 3 star general," and the guard would just say, "I'm sorry, sir. You do not have clearance to enter this facility. So you're going to have to back your car up and go back out." So everything was like this all over. This particular building was classified. And so I didn't have an iPhone or cell phone at the time, because nobody did. But I did have a pager, but I had to leave the pager outside in my car, because you could not take any type of electronic equipment into this location because of the security. So I went in, and he took me into this area. And to go into this clean room where they had all of the things we were going to view that day, I had to put on a cap to keep my hair out. I had to put on this coat to make sure that I didn't leave any debris back. I had to wear gloves, and I had to put on these little electrostatic booties so that I didn't leave any dust behind and did not create any electromagnetic static electricity, because everything in there was very significant electromagnetic, and one little thing. And if you short circuited something, that might be a $3.5 million satellite. So, you know, you just got to be careful. So we went and did all of the stuff that he was going to show me. And so as we exited, we went out into the little preparation room. And so I'm taking off my cap, taking off my jacket, and all of this. Well, the EG&G escort guy did this all the time. And so, boom, 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 he had all of his stuff off and secured. And he said, okay, see you, doc. And so he left. And so I was maybe like 1 minute behind him. So I got all of my stuff arranged. And so as I stepped out, there were these double doors, and it led into a hallway. So as I entered that hallway, there was a gentleman off to my right that was in his Class A Air Force uniform, and from his insignias, I could tell that he was a missile launch guy. So as I went up to him, he said, "Hey, Doc, I've got something to show you." Well, the thing is, I saw all of these people, hundreds and thousands of people on sick call, in the emergency room, on annual physicals and stuff. So a lot of times for me, I might see 15 people in a single day. And then, you know, 6 months later, you know, I don't remember who those 15 people were, but because coming to the flight surgeon's office was important for them, they would remember, you know, whatever we did on that day. So, he recognized me and said, "I've got something to show you." I said, "Oh, okay. What is it?" And he did this. He said, "I've got something to show you that even you have never seen." So I said, "Well, okay. Well, show it to me." Now, then the reason I believe he did that was that on the Cape, there were like 25 different classified locations on there. And so to enter each of those locations, you have to have a special security clearance. So I had gone through like 13 different locations. And so on my little necklace thing, I had 13 different ID cards so that when I went to this location, I could show him this ID. If I go to this location, show him this ID. Well, this guy only had like one or two. So he was very limited in where he could go and what he could see. And we did that for compartmentalized security. We had so many different things going on that we didn't want people in building A to know what was going on in building G. So those people could not interact and certainly could not enter. So he said, "I'm going to show you this." So I stepped in behind him into this little office that was there to the right. As soon as we entered the office, he shut the door and locked it. So I thought, now, that's pretty strange. And then there were louvered blinds. And so he closed all of the blinds. And now I'm thinking, you know, hold it. You know, this is getting kind of funny. You know, I don't know what's going on here. So he said, "Just a minute, I'll show you." So there were four computer stations inside this office. So he sat down at one of the computer stations, which I assumed was his. So he turned on the computer, turned on the console, and he starts doing some things looking for something. So, you know, we're just sort of chatting, nothing important that I would remember later. Well, all of a sudden, this screen came up, and he said, "Here it is. You take my seat." So he moved over one seat to his left, and I sit down in his chair, which was directly in front of the computer screen. Now, when I looked at this screen, it looked like a closed circuit TV feed, but it was totally clean. There was no time or date or location noted on it. There was no evidence of any classification marker or anything else. It was just this raw feed from the closed circuit television, and it looked like it was, you know, sort of a typical military hangar. So when I looked at it, it looked like just a regular hangar, with the exception of what was inside the hangar. Now then, what I saw was a saucer vehicle. It looked sort of like an egg. Eggs are a little bit oblong. If you sort of smashed it down to where it was even all the way around, that was what it looked like. The surface was pearly white. There were no rivets, no seams, no doors, no windows, no pitot tubes, no control surfaces, nothing I could identify as a propulsion system. But as soon as I saw it, I thought, this is a test vehicle. Now then, along the beam of it, the midsection of it, there was a black rectangle that had been painted horizontally from the 1230 to 230 position, and then from the 330 to the 530 position. As it moved, I later saw that there were four of these rectangles. The other two were at the 630 to 830 position and the 930 to 1130 position. So around the center of it, sort of like a belt, was these four large black rectangles. At the 3 o'clock position above the beam, at the 6 o'clock and 9 o'clock position, as I saw it move later, there were vertical rectangles. Now, then the reason these impressed me as being in a research vehicle was that the surface was so smooth and clear that if you had not put something on it, you couldn't tell what was going on. You even look back at like the Saturn V launch vehicles to more properly monitor the vehicles during launch. They painted large rectangles on all of the launch vehicles so yeah. that as it began to move, you could tell when it was rotating and all of this, because if they left it all white, the videos from the monitoring screens wouldn't necessarily pick it up. But if the rectangles move in any way, you're going to detect the motion of the vehicle. So as I'm looking at this thing, I commented to him, "Who on earth would make something like that?" And he said, "Well, I can't tell you that." And I said, "Why would we design something like this?" And here's exactly what he did. He said, "We got it from them." Now then, he did not explain what that meant, but clearly, to my mind, he was saying this is based on a UFO, a flying saucer. So I assumed that most likely a contractor had been given the specifications and were trying to reverse engineer what somebody in the Air Force had found. And they said, "Well, we want to do this." To sort of put this into perspective, here's something I tell people. If we today took an F-22, which is our most advanced air-to-air fighter, air superiority aircraft, and we transported it back to 1914, and we said, "Okay, we're going to give it to the finest American aircraft engineers, and we want to give the United States a huge advantage in World War I by providing them an entire F-22. Now then, you make F-22s in 1914, it doesn't matter what anyone else does. You're going to defeat everybody. Nobody has the capability of doing that. Hmm. Now, the only problem is that the engineers are limited because of their knowledge in 1914. So they look at the F-22, and the first thing they're going to say is, "Well, where's the propeller? You know, there's no propeller anywhere on this thing." And so you say, "Well, it doesn't need a propeller. It's got jet engines." Well, they don't know what jet engines are. They feel the surface of it, and they say, "We make all of our aircraft out of wood. None of this feels like wood, and this metal here on the front feels really funny." And so we say, "Oh, well, that's because it's a special nickel titanium alloy. It has a special surface coating with radar absorbent material so that if a radar signal is seeking this craft, it's going to disrupt the return signature to the radar so that no one can know where it is. And they're just going to look at me with funny looks on their faces and say, what's a radar?
Yeah.
Now, even though this is only 100 years of human technology, there is no one, no matter what they try to do in 1914, that can reproduce an F-22. They don't know what computers are. That's 100 years of human technology. Now then, if we capture a vehicle, say 1947 in Roswell, and it is 5,000 years ahead of us, we can look at it and we're going to say, well, where's the propulsion system? Where are the flight controls? How are you going to do this? We would be in the same position of those aeronautical engineers in 1914 trying to figure out what does all this technology mean? So there is no way on earth we're going to immediately be able to replicate the UAP that we discovered. And so we're going to have to take baby steps, little by little by little by little, to try to figure out how are we going to reverse engineer this thing. So in 1992, that was 45 years after the Roswell incident, and there were other incidents after that. To put it into perspective, this was only 3 years after Bob Lazar gave his account of what he was doing with EG&G at Area 51, and his description of a sports model flying saucer is sort of like what I was seeing. I don't know if they were in any way related, but what I was looking at was totally foreign to anything that I knew. Well, this thing activated and it lifted off the surface about 3 feet. There were electromagnetic discharges going on around the surface of the craft, and there was some other stuff happening. But because of the nature of the other stuff, if this was a testbed model, they whoever was making it likely moved forward with the technology. So if I described the clues about that technology, I might inadvertently give away classified information for what the later models could do. So I have not discussed that with anyone. But this thing lifted off about 3 feet off the ground, and then just as smooth as could be, it rotated 360 degrees clockwise. It rotated 360 degrees counterclockwise so that it was in exactly the same position as when it rose. It then moved left and right, forward and backward, just as though you were doing testing of the control mechanisms, making sure everything's working right. Well, it was just sitting there like this, and then all of a sudden, oh, I forgot to mention one very important thing. The reason I called the one section the 12 o'clock position, or the forward section, was because as it rotated, I could see U.S. Air Force written on the beam of it right there. And then just above that was the U.S. flight insignia. So now then, I'm already surprised because I'm looking at a stinking flying saucer. And now as it rotates, I see that it says U.S. Air Force and has an Air Force flight insignia. Now, I have to remind people, the U.S. Air Force does not build aircraft. The Air Force will give details of what they want an aircraft to be. They provide those details to contractors and contractor consortiums. They figure out their version of what it is. And so the contractors will bring out copies of what they've developed, and the Air Force will assess them to see which one is most successful for the U.S. Air Force, and then they will give a contract to that corporation or consortium, and then they will begin to create a production line. The production line will produce production line aircraft, and then the U.S. Air Force will purchase those craft from the contractor. Now, since this was a test vehicle, as far as I'm concerned, it still belonged to a contractor or contractor consortium, even though it said U.S. Air Force on it. Now, then at the very top of it was this little mast, and three umbilical lines came off this. And so those umbilical lines most likely fed in electricity, circuitry for controls, and all of this kind of stuff, which is another reason I assumed that it was a test vehicle. If it was a fully functional craft, you wouldn't need umbilicals to provide electricity or anything like that. That would all be internal to the craft. So because it required the umbilicals, that was another reason I considered it to be a test aircraft. Well, all of a sudden, it tilted to a 45-degree angle. Now, I've flown helicopters, and I've flown T-38s, F-16s, and I know the aerodynamics. We have no craft anywhere that can assume a 45-degree angle of attack and remain motionless. And yet, this vehicle did this. So that just completely blew me away. Unfortunately, just about that time, there was a knock on the door, and somebody said, "Hey, what's going on in there? Why is the door locked?" Well, this major that was showing me all this stuff, he panics. He clicks off the computer, clicks off the console. He looks at me and says, "Don't tell anyone I showed you this." Well, I'm sitting there thinking, "You just showed me a flying saucer. Who on earth am I going to tell that I just saw a flying saucer that you showed me?" Well, he goes over to the door. He opens the door. This lieutenant colonel, and I believe there were two captains with him, stepped in. The lieutenant colonel looked sort of funny at both of us and said, "Why was the door locked?" Well, this major said, "Well, I had this skin thing that I was afraid might be cancer, so I wanted to show it to the doc. So just for privacy, I locked the door while I was showing it to him." So now they all look at me. My mind is racing, because if that video had shown any degree of classification and it had been showed to me inappropriately, I would have to report the whole bunch of them. But it didn't have that. I had already encountered astronauts and pilots and other flight crews who had witnessed UAPs before, in space and in flight within normal aircraft capabilities. And as they would tell the stuff, they would then turn around and say, "But I'm not telling anyone about it." So, you know, there was a clear unspoken rule that when something happened, you don't tell anybody about it. So this lieutenant colonel's looking at me, and I just said, the skin lesion wasn't cancer, nothing to worry about. I got to get back to my clinic. And so I booked it out of there. I went and got in my car, and I left the Cape. I drove down Highway A1A to Patrick Air Force Base. And so that was a 30-minute drive. And the whole way down there, I'm thinking, what on earth am I going to do? And I decided, yeah, I'm going to do the same thing all these other people have done. I'm not going to say anything. I'm not going to tell somebody I just saw a flying saucer. That might be a good way to end my career right there. So I did not tell anyone. It was 15 years before I even told my wife. But then finally this year in April of 2025, I retired from the Defense Health Agency. And so I was no longer part of the Department of Defense. And so on the 4th of May and the 5th of May, I had interviews and explained what I had seen back in 1992. Well, I didn't expect it to blow up the way it did. 3 days later, there's an article in Newsweek magazine about me and my story. The New York Post is running it. It's in newspapers and other news sources all over the world within days. And so since that time, I have been telling this story to people from Argentina to Malta to the Philippines and just about everywhere in between.
It was Reed Summers. Great question. One I'm still exploring. I've been involved on this topic most of my life. My father was a highly gifted telepathic communicator and was basically contacted by non-human intelligence back in the mid-90s and received what he feels are a series of communiques advising humanity exopolitically on the nature of what and who is involved down on the ground with us. So I was exposed to this from a very early age. I grew up in the UFO conference circuit, you could say, running around the halls of MUFON annual symposia as a 10-year-old, 12-year-old, and beyond. I met many of the big names, you could say, of ufology back even back then. And so I've been kind of walking around this and thinking about it and cultivating my own kind of intellectual sense that, yes, we're not alone. That's just an instinctual sense I've had. And then you could say an intuitive sense that there is kind of a an intuitive kind of knowing that we are in some form of longitudinal engagement with non-human. And then I kind of responded to a personal sense of calling to get professionally involved on this topic following the hearings in 2023 with David Grush, Ryan Graves, and David Frazier. And a sense actually at the first Soul Symposium that, and I need to play a part and help educate and inform the process to the best of my ability, but also help the public approach this because I see every month or every maybe quarter of the year, tens of thousands of new people from the public piling into this space based on the UAP hearings in Congress, other news releases, 3i Atlas, things like that, that are coming out. And so people are stumbling into this confusing, enigmatic environment where there are a lot of competing narratives. There is disinformation at play. There's poor mental discipline historically on this topic at play. And so as someone impassioned by logic, caution, reason, that tremendous historic global event of the human NHI interface and really kind of residing out on the front lines of the phenomenon, out where there is insufficient data, out where there are indicators, but not necessarily evidence, and responsibly speculating on those front lines, asking the right questions that could ultimately lead to more targeted research and field investigation into the phenomenon. And in the Human Institute, we are tackling the institutional and policy ramifications of an NHI presence and what it looks like for to frame out the international preparedness and response plan for if and when NHI is affirmed to exist at a federal level or at the level of a governing body, or if not that, how to begin to articulate our human kind of response and rules of engagement that need to exist even at the civilian level to safeguard public the public awareness of the topic and also individuals who are deeply affected by it personally. Great questions. Well, it did run throughout the family. I don't know of it running in the generation before his, but my uncle was highly involved on the topic, and others as well. My mother, and it's quite a story. It's actually a really amazing story. I encourage you to have him on, Marshall Summers, and basically where it begins is in the late 70s. Marshall was kind of cultivating an intuitive sense of how to communicate beyond words, how to connect, you could say, relationally. And that ultimately culminated in him being a special educator for individuals with multiple disabilities. So, individuals who were highly autistic, who had speech impairment, auditory visual impairments. And so it gave him a chance to explore this arena of extrasensory perception and communication. And he had spontaneous communication experiences with those he was working with, beyond words, without language. And so this non-physical NHI began to kind of guide him in his work. And then ultimately, as his capability set grew and grew, began to basically transmit communications through him as to many of them regarding the nature of contact, the nature of the physical engagement taking place in the skies, in the ocean, on land with this phenomenon, which was a shock to him because he was not a student of ufology or any of this. Hmm. He was open, but not inclined. My mother was kind of different. She was inclined and she was extremely intuitively connected to that as a reality. And then in the late 90s, this grew into, as his capabilities as a telepathic communicator grew, another form of life communicated to him, he would say, and that is a physical NHI, a physical set of observing entities who were, in their words, highly alarmed at the nature of contact taking place and how ill-prepared humanity was for it, and basically providing an exopolitical set of disclosures, briefings, as to the nature of who and what is actually physically in the world engaging with us. And so, and that was a shock. And it actually took him several years to grapple with, can I trust this source? Is this information, accurate? How do I know it's accurate? How do I vet this? And it was a combination of basically the proof is in the pudding. Like, does the message check out regarding what we can logically and observationally see about the phenomenon in the historical record? And does it intuitively check out? And also does it honor key principles of free will and a consent and personal sovereignty, which have become very important concepts for me in my more recent work working with experiencers. And my concern is that in some NHI initiated encounters, those very basic kind of rules of life, what every sentient life form should be accorded, free will, sovereignty, are being directly violated and disregarded, right? There are other entities present. There are forceful communications being impelled upon the mind. And if one does not protect themselves, engage in some kind of psychic or mental shielding activity, which my father and I have developed to a very significant degree, you might find that those thoughts that are not your own enter your own mind and you begin voicing them and you become kind of a mouthpiece for a perspective that you don't know where the origin of that is. And it hasn't happened often, but it's happened enough to tell us that somebody is targeting U.S. citizens with non-contact weaponry, probably given or facilitated by the defense industry, to suppress conversations about the disclosure of the phenomenon and the government's historic involvement in it and collaboration with it. And so, those are topics I talk about, right? So I'm not talking about nuts and bolts craft in the sky. I'm talking about the controller. I'm talking about who's behind the wheel, what motivates them, what is the framework by which the public can decode their presence and intent without relying on the government to handhold and spoon feed and to disinform, right? So that's a dangerous act, when you go out into the public and start talking logically to people with credibility and get them geared up with their own toolkit to assess what the hell's going on when there are a lot of human actors that don't want that to happen, let alone for conversations to take place regarding their historic collaboration and competition with NHI and all of the sequela, right? And I view crash retrievals, reverse engineering, tech of unknown, that's sequela. That's not the phenomenon. That's not the it or the true problem. The true problem is that there is a covert set of activities by non-human entities taking place. The government knows. They classified it early under the highest levels of the secrecy apparatus, right out of, the Department of Energy and the nuclear secrets infrastructure. And they sought to engage with it, study it, try to gain parity with it, recover its technologies, weaponize those technologies for prosaic, but also for non-prosaic intentions. And it's an absolute mess. I chafe at the NHI acronym at times because it is too much of a catch-all. it's an inflated category that can include almost anything. So I think within NHI, which, and I understand a new term, a new acronym was needed to circumvent all of the obfuscation of the phenomenon generated around little green men, aliens, et cetera, all of the pop culture stuff that I think was purposefully put out to ontologically prepare people to normalize paranormal phenomenon, but also to kind of misdirect. So within NHI, I think there are a number of phenomena at play, and I consider them as part of our extended ecosystem. I would take the ETI on one side of the NHI question and say, yes, I think there are strong indications we're dealing with a biological form of life operating structured technology with capabilities, demonstrated capabilities, and offensive capabilities as well. There is a record of UAP potentially downing human craft, affecting ground observers in a targeted sense, not just as a result of their propulsion, for example. And so on the ETI side, that's a project. We have to figure out, are we being engaged by an extraterrestrial intelligence? If so, that's the biggest story ever. That's the biggest crisis ever. These have been historically described as angels or malevolent entities, you know, and so on and so forth into culture. But, you know, that non-physical component could be at play at the same time as the ETI. The ETI being, by all accounts, highly telepathic. But I think they have technologies of mind. They have broken through the barrier that is imposed, self-imposed barrier that we imagine prevents the physical from the non-physical, the non-material from interacting, right? And so they have broken through that barrier, let's say, and they're interacting with entities that are non-physical NHI. And so I think there is a swirl of activity. Part of that, I think, is being kicked up like dust to keep us from clearly identifying key components, right? There is a smoke and mirrors campaign. During the 20th century, we flashed the universe with nuclear detonations, global conflict, environmental destruction. It's a clear techno-bio signature that's easily detectable, let's imagine. And all of a sudden, a hockey stick of UFO activity goes up, right? And there have been clear shifts in its programmatic activity in the world. So it's such as to say that there's an arc of engagement, a beginning, a middle, and an end, with obvious risk to flight safety at the minimum. And then other potentially more shocking engagements, such as the 1970 B-52 incident, where a Green Beret recovery team was sent out into the Laotian jungle during Vietnam to recover a B-52 that had been downed after a UAP UFO was sighted flying in its vicinity. They found the craft. It had landed. It had been placed on the forest floor. Trees had not been cut down. It had not crashed. It had been placed on the forest floor. There was no damage to the craft. How is that possible? In the middle of the jungle. And on board, the whole crew was still strapped into their seats, everyone where they were, but the entire crew had been strategically, with precision, laser precision, mutilated. Ears had been excised. Reproductive organs had been removed. There was very little blood. And again, laser precision, obviously requiring highly advanced technology to do this. Just because someone felt good doesn't mean it was good. There are many ways to manipulate consciousness and the biochemistry that gives rise to emotion. We can do it. Why couldn't they do it? So we have to do a much better job than just taking it at face value that people say it was good. And I don't want to take that away from people either. But at a research investigatory level, we have a project in front of us as a species. And my hope is to help activate the right authorities and the right capacities within society to get out there and figure out what is going on, to validate these claims or invalidate them. I'll interject there, regardless of how it went or what it felt like or the ultimate effect on the individual, it is a crime in the national criminal framework that governs our country. Like, humans can't abduct humans. So are we going to apply those same legal frameworks to non-humans? That's a key question for all the legal scholars out there. To what extent do those apply? Human trafficking is a crime, right? Undisclosed medical experimentation, reproductive interventions. Like, we cannot do this to each other, but we are okay with letting others do it to us in an undisclosed fashion. And so the policy would be a full remove and reset. All NHI entities must remove themselves from the Earth system completely and provide some respectful distance and time for humanity to acknowledge their existence, which is important and profound, and devise our human-centered response. Human-centered meaning centered in values and the human intent, which has yet to even be articulated in this context. And then we re-engage diplomatically. And I would say if any entity would not give us that space and the allotment of time to devise contact on our terms, I would say they're here with intentions that are not in our best interest.
So, I mean, well, the feedback has been extremely positive, but like anything, you can have 99 great things and one, let's say, constructive critic, and that's the only one that you remember because you want to fix that. So I'll get to that maybe a little bit later. So I think, you know, the general purpose of the meeting was, first of all, to, you know, acknowledge the fact that UAP are not a U.S. phenomenon alone. The reasoning for why scientists or military or others have come forward with their notions that there's something here. It was not meant to go into depth. So if you were an aficionado or somebody who's totally up on everything around the matters of UAP and its extended agendas of people looking into it. I mean, I'm not even convinced what is real about it. And I've been in it now for 14 years. I know that there's definitely something, and I have lots of notions about it, and there you can nail it down. But to definitively say it's one thing escapes a simple 5-minute conversation. I mean, science in itself is not a series of statements about reality. It's a series of questions about reality of, you know, here's the observation. What does it mean? Yeah. And, you know, it's funny. I just got off our weekly meeting with the Sol Core group, you know, and Jonathan and Mara were both extreme. And they're both, of course, they live in Europe. We're both extremely excited that, you know, they can now spend some time with European groups. There's a Swiss subgroup especially that are interested in the phenomenon, so they don't have to, you know, have a conversation with somebody 9 hours difference, 6 to 9 hour difference. They can actually have conversations with people in their own time zone. You know, I mean, just think of it. The totality of the European community is bigger than the size of the United States in terms of the total number of people. And, you know, that has gotten worldwide attention. I mean, and a lot in all the major newspapers in Europe. So, you know, the subject matter is not off the agenda. It's just the European community or European journals, newspapers, media, et cetera, had a bit of a higher standard of what it is that was required to break through. Well, first of all, Carl gave, I think, the second or he gave a talk, which was, as usual, tremendous, you know, with his insights and scholarliness about the matter, you know, and depth, you know, in typical Carl's style, you know, just barraged with data, information, insights, et cetera. So, so I thought his talk was great and can be, and his PowerPoint, frankly, could be mined for a paper or two if Carl were willing to write for Sol. Second, you know, I don't fault Carl for saying that this round has ended, because I think he's very connected, of course, to the writing of the UAPDA, so probably feels disheartened because of the politics that he cannot change. But having said that, it's also clear that it's not over, you know, that there still seems to be some life in the UAPDA, as evidenced by things that some politicians have been saying, as well as workarounds. So I think Carl can take heart in that, in the fact that he's driven it to this level. He's opened the door at the congressional and senatorial level. Well, I mean, we did show a couple of the videos of the sightings, as well as pictures. Those were Jake's pictures. And James, of course, talked about his work on the last day. I'm literally deeply involved in the data analysis, and that probably won't be ready by the end of the year. We're still dealing with some figuring out what the files are, the timing of the files, et cetera. So there will be results, but they're not going to be, frankly, as definitive as I would like. But what they're doing is, you know, there's lots of cool stuff there, but I can't write a paper. Well, I think the way to look at it is you've got three communities within SkyWatcher and cultures. There's the science community that I represent and a couple of others. There's the military. I mean, people might not have noticed, but there were several guys with their girlfriends or wives hanging around with Jake, who actually were all out on the range with us for each of the events as security or helping set things up. And so they were all there, great guys. Scary at first when I first met them, but very professional guys. So you got the military community or military culture, and then you've got Alex Klokas, who is funneling money from other people as well as some of his own through corporation. Again, it's nonprofit. To get money to SkyWatcher to collect data. And so there's a move fast and break. And I don't think a conference has to have a theme per se. I mean, the theme was UAP. But there are targeted information settings and groups within the totality of the UAP community that we want to focus on. I mean, certainly one of the next meetings is going to be in DC, and it will be smaller, and it will be probably dedicated to trying to get staffers and or congresspeople there. And therefore it will be limited. We don't want a 500 person room. We want something just for a day, because I think you can keep doing these things and not accomplish a goal if you don't focus. And so we're going to have a few focused events probably in San Francisco, LA. Regression. I don't see any regression. I think there were some complaints that because the notion of CE5 of some kind came up in my discussion with Jake, there were a couple of people in the audience who thought it was unscientific and that my presence was somehow condoning CE5. And I'm like, well, I mean, look, it's been, the notion has been around for 20 plus years. So that it was part of a discussion should surprise nobody. And I reject, frankly, anybody saying that it shouldn't be, and that it's not science. And I'm sorry, science is just what we don't understand yet. Well, I think the last speaker, on whistleblowers needed, that was great and very emotional.
Jeff Nusitelli.
Yes, thank you. Nusitelli, Jeff. And I think that there still needs to be work there done. I don't know that the Sol Foundation is the best forum for that, because in part that's lobbying, and there are several great people on that. And one of their focuses, of course, is helping whistleblowers. So I think to the extent that we can help the Disclosure Fund with their efforts for whistleblowers, that would be great, because I think they should probably take the legal lead. You know, I've been following it. I mean, mostly I follow Avi on it because I feel like he'll give the most credible science on it. You know, and I think as he's pointed out, it's doing a few strange things. Now, strange doesn't mean alien, but strange means it's not a normal comet. You know, by the very definition. And there, I saw something again this morning I needed a follow-up on, that there's a potential second indication that it seems to be accelerating. Now, I don't know whether that's real or not, you know, but it looked like it was coming from a credible source. So I think, you know, look, what Avi has been able to do is take what would otherwise be a banal, prosaic event of just another, and let the astronomers hold the bag. Avi's ripped the bag off of these individuals and said, "No, I'm going to show you that you still can't say that it's not a alien vehicle." And I think he is magnificently frustrating the astronomer community, who want to just stuff it in a normal old boring comet bag. And so kudos to him on all of that, because he's relentless.
But Avi's just saying, be scientific, be curious, let's study this, let's get involved. I'd like to think out there are a whole generation of children perhaps seeing this on YouTube, watching viral clips online, and it pushes them on to get involved in that kind of arena, to be curious. And maybe along the line, one of these things comes in that does show unique, you know. Right.
Well, this is already showing something unique. I mean, I think Avi's participation in this has elevated the discussion and made it far more interesting to a lot of people. I mean, he's now, you know, as you said, on bazillions of, you know, news shows or podcasts. I think a little bit. I don't think we should get our hopes up that it's going to change everything. But enough people are going to watch it that it's going to create a receptive community. I mean, this is any change in culture, especially something as momentous as Are We Alone? Is absent the mothership landing, you know, in the Atlantic, you know, where everybody can see it, or what's left of the White House lawn. I was one of the speakers. Multiple individuals who paid for the right to listen to us six people talk about cancer and artificial intelligence. But I was asked to speak a little bit about the UFO stuff that I'm interested in. And, you know, Richard Branson was there for most of the meeting. I'm not allowed to name anybody who was there other than myself. And there were some important people there. I kind of made I talked about the general notion of it. And I made the comment, well, if everybody wants to know the real secrets, I can be bribed with martinis. Well, that was an opening that everybody used. And so I didn't drink all the martinis I was offered, but all anybody wanted to talk about afterwards. I mean, a lot of people just want to talk about the UFO stuff. We were interested. And I did the same thing that I did on the Rogan show, where I spent the first, you know, portion talking about the regular science to establish credibility. And then I talked about the UAP. I did. It was about
the theme.
Yeah. About focusing. And which is one of the reasons why making three or four focused smaller meetings would be better. We'll still stream them. We had some problems with the streaming, glitches turning it on for some people, and we're trying to make amends. We're sorry. We really are. So I think having streaming for each of these other events will alleviate people, you know, and their fear of missing out. But we'll get the people in the room who matter from a, you know, from a, you know, they're going to make the, they're going to make the changes we need point of view. So I feel good about that. So that was really what I was talking about. What is the normal range of sizes? Autistic brains, and that's the work actually. The reason why Maria Modi was involved is that's her research focus, the shape of brain regions and differences in autistics. But luckily, the data set that we used, I think it was the German data set, of MRIs also included schizophrenias. And so we had for all of those individuals, deep psychological and intelligence values set up. So we could do a meta correlation of brain region sizes. So we had written several years ago before anything like this was widely done, algorithms which could call out the various brain regions, get volumes, surface areas, et cetera, automatically. Believe it or not, that was not anything commonly done. I agree. I think there's certainly lots of consciousness discussions, and frankly, whole symposia about the nature of human consciousness and what it is. I think Stuart Hameroff and Roger Penrose are in some ways leading the charge on taking consciousness out of the hands of the neurophysiologists and saying it's not just neurons that there's...
That's all for this episode of That UFO Podcast. Thank you so much for listening and watching. If you enjoyed the show, please follow, subscribe, and leave a rating or review wherever you get your podcast. It really helps others find the show. If you're watching on YouTube, hit like, subscribe, and turn on notifications so you don't miss future episodes. You can also support the show directly and get early access, ad-free episodes, and bonus content on Patreon or by subscribing on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube memberships. All the links are over at thatufopodcast.com or in the show description below, along with merchandise and more. Don't forget you can also pick up a copy of my book, Atlas of Unidentified Flying Objects, available now in all good bookstores and through online retailers, including Amazon. Big thank you again to all of you for listening and tuning in. Until next time, keep looking up. You never know what you might see.
It wasn't a tic-tac and not quite a saucer, more like a hubcap designed by Chaucer, a little baroque and quite steampunk, like Alice was playing bass for the Parliament of Funk. The little fucker hovered right outside of my window, and when I shoved out the screen, he made it an issue. I don't think he expected me to see his ass, but I'd had some champagne and smoke.